From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Illinois is home to a lot of historic publications. The major newspapers, of course, from the Interocean to the Tribune to the Defender. There was also Jet Magazine. And in the world of poetry, Poetry, the monthly magazine dedicated to its namesake art form, has its origins in Chicago, dating all the way back to 1912. The magazine became famous nationally and internationally for publishing poetry from the likes of Carl Sandburg, Ezra Pound, and Marianne Moore. But in more recent years, the Poetry Foundation, which publishes the magazine, has faced criticism and controversy. There are those who say the magazine has not kept up with the times, especially with how it handled its response to the killing of George Floyd in 2020. Critics have also said poetry was not including enough poets from marginalized groups or people of color and not providing financial aid to artists during the COVID-19 pandemic. But the foundation has taken strides to correct course. Back in 2021, Michelle Boone became the first woman and person of color to become president of the foundation. Then the magazine reached another milestone in the form of my next guest, Adrian Matika. He's the magazine's first Black editor in its 110-year history, as well as the Ruth Lilly Professor of Poetry at Indiana University. I first spoke with him shortly after his appointment last year. We're revisiting that conversation today. Because this conversation's on tape, we're not taking calls live, but you can always let us know what you think by emailing talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Okay, here now is my conversation with the editor of poetry, Adrian Matika. Adrian, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian. I know we have so many things to talk about, but I just have to take a moment to shout out Jet Magazine, which is one of the first magazines that I read when I was a kid, way before I knew anything about poetry. Or Poetry Magazine, I was reading Jet. So I'm so pleased to know that's from Chicago.
Yeah, absolutely. A long tradition there. I want to begin just by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself. How do you mentioned you started reading Jet Magazine. How did you get into poetry and decide this was going to be your life's work?
You know, to keep it tight, I have to say that I wanted to be a rapper when I was a kid. And I was terrible at it. I was an absolutely horrible MC. And so I ended up writing song lyrics for a band, doing a lot of adjacent things to music. And then when I was in college, I discovered poetry. And it felt to me like an art form that somehow used words to create music. And I felt, you know, I just fell in love with it when I was 19 and haven't stopped.
You were born overseas, right? And grew up in Indiana. Was there was poetry a part of your upbringing?
You know, yeah, it was not at all. I was born in Germany. My father was in the military and my mother was a translator for the UN. And so we lived in Frankfurt for a long time and then came back to the US. And it wasn't until I was, I don't know, maybe in grade school or middle school that I really started reading seriously and, you know, thinking about literature as something that I wanted to have as a part of my life, not as a writer, just becoming a really avid reader. I think most poets start out reading. You know, we find things that inspire us, Where the Sidewalk Ends, or, Gwendolyn Brooks, or Dr. Seuss.
Yeah,
you know, there's so many different ways that we can find our ways to poetry, and it's not always poems that bring us there.
That's great. I read that one to my kids fairly often, Where the Sidewalk Ends. Shel Silverstein. So at what point do you say this is something I can do professionally?
You know, it's funny because I am in such a fortunate position to be the editor of the most prominent poetry magazine in America. And so when I think about the work I do to support other poets and to support the art that I love so much, I think of it separate from the writing that I do. I've never really felt like a professional poet. You know, I write books, I teach poetry, I do all of these things that are adjacent to the art, but I wouldn't have any idea what it would look like to just be a poet. I don't know. I would love to be that, just, you know, hanging around, writing poems and thinking about literature. But it seems to me that poetry is directly connected to action. And what I mean is that most of the poets I know are also community organizers. They're also librarians. They're also doctors. They're also, carpenters. Everybody I know who writes poetry also does something else that's very active in the world and allows them to think more deeply about language.
Yeah, I guess you have to go back to maybe the 1800s to get the sort of poet in the garret
full time. <right. laughs> You have to find a benefactor.
Yeah, exactly.
But I don't mean to sidestep the question. I think when I was in college, I didn't understand what it would mean to have a life that was centered around poetry, but I knew I wanted to do it. And I knew that was something that I wanted for myself. So I dedicated myself to the study of literature and study of poetry, and was lucky enough through a lot of different random things to end up as a professor. And that allowed me to think more deeply about who I wanted to be as an artist and also as a community citizen. So there were a lot of steps to it, but if anybody who wants to be a poet, all they have to do is pick up a pen and start writing. You know, that's one side of it. And the other thing they need to do is pick up our magazine or pick up any literary magazine and read poetry. The combination of those two things can lead you directly to the artistic space that you might want to be a part of.
So how do you become editor of the most prominent poetry magazine in America, if not the world? At least the English
speaking. But accidentally, I think. I was an editor for a very long time. I worked for a literary journal called Kalu, which is one of the most prominent literary journals of the African diaspora for a while. I also was an editor for a magazine called River Styx. That's one of the greatest independent literary magazines in America. And I was also an editor for Boulevard. I edited multiple magazines over the last 20 years, but never full-time. I was always teaching while I was editing. And so when this opportunity to kind of step away from the classroom and just focus Monday through Friday, and also Saturday and Sunday, on creating space for other poets, I couldn't pass it up. So they approached me along with a lot of other people, and I was lucky enough to be the finalist that they chose.
What sort of changes are you hoping to implement at the magazine?
Well, we've already started. You know, I started in June at the magazine, and the 110th anniversary issue was the October issue, and that was my very first one. And I want to just take a moment to linger in that, to think that there's a magazine dedicated to poetry that's been here for 11 decades is just astounding to me and so wonderful. And unparalleled too. I mean, it's so hard to support any kind of art, whether it's visual art or literature, but to do it for 110 years is mind-boggling. And so we celebrated that 110th with my first issue with a magazine that also announced what I'd hoped to do as an editor. And among those things is I just wanted to make more space. I wanted to create room for poets who hadn't felt like they were invited into the poetry conversation before. You know, I was lucky enough to be in the magazine in 2012. So, you know, 10 years ago, that was the first time I was in the magazine. And I was the only Black poet in the entire issue. And I was the only poet of color in the entire issue. So 10 years ago, when you picked up Poetry Magazine, it was an incredibly homogenous experience. There wasn't a lot of diversity at all. And, you know, one of my mandates was to try to figure out how to change that, how to make the magazine look more like what American and actually global poetics looks like right now. And so I was lucky because the editorial team that was in place when I got here had already begun that work, had already been trying to figure out how to imagine the magazine in a more 21st century way. And so I got to kind of step in midstream and start to, lend my editorial vision to it. And so one of the very first things I did was start thinking about who hadn't been in the magazine. And so if anyone who's listening gets the chance to pick up the October issue, there's a folio of poetry by a poet named Carolyn M. Rogers. And Carolyn was the co-founder of Third World Press, a very prominent Black arts movement poet from Chicago, and she'd never been in the magazine. She published many books, had been a finalist for the National Book Award, but there was no room in the version of poetry that existed when she was alive for her poems. So we put 40 pages of her work in there in my very first issue, along with some other ephemera like photographs and notebook images to show people the work that Carolyn M. Rogers did. The fact that she was here, like right down the street from the magazine, and there still wasn't room for her is astounding to me. And she's not the only one. There were so many poets who just either were not, space wasn't made for them, or they didn't feel like they were welcome and didn't submit, that I would like to highlight going forward. Next, I think 3 years, we're going to try to have a folio in almost every issue that spotlights a poet who has not been in the magazine before.
Well, that raises an interesting question, and I'm glad you brought up Carolyn Marie Rogers because I wanted to ask about her. But what do you understand about why that was the case? Was it ignorance or just sort of a willful discrimination? Or because how do you fix it, right, if you don't understand the root causes of that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that I want to be careful because I know, you know, I couldn't presume to know what the editors were thinking, but I know what American literature looked like across the board at that time and still does in many parts of it, where there is a preference for a particular kind of voice. There's a preference for, a more homogenized idea of what literature can be. And so when I look at the magazine in 2012 and there's only one Black poet in it, that's not emblematic of the poetry community, but it's emblematic at that time of the editorial community. There weren't a lot of editors of color. There weren't a lot of publishers of color. Third World Press is one of the, you know, I think it's the oldest Black publisher in the US. I think their 50th anniversary was last year. There weren't a lot of avenues that were curated by people from marginalized communities. So when you have an editor who's leaning into their own editorial proclivities, and it's for writing that's like their writing, or by people who look like they do, then there's not going to be any room for Black poets or Latinx poets or trans poets. I hope that our editorial team is thinking about it a little bit differently and thinking about the quality of the work rather than who wrote it. And when you start to just think about how good a poem is, then it naturally lends itself to a diverse group of writers. There are so many amazing poets working right now. I mean, there are more poets writing poetry, reading poetry, publishing poetry than there ever have been in the entire history of humanity, right? It's just a fact. And so to be able to, in some very small way, open up possibilities and give a stage to those poets has been a great joy since I joined the editorial team.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to my conversation with Adrian Matika, the latest editor for Poetry, the monthly magazine dedicated to its namesake art form. The magazine has its origins in Chicago going back to 1912, but it's experienced controversy in recent years. Now it's looking to correct course, with Matika leading the effort. Because this conversation is on tape, we're not taking your calls, but you could always let us know what you thought by leaving a voicemail at 217-300-2121. We need to take a break in a few minutes, but before we do, I want to ask about, you talked about how poetry is not, it's rare that would be, if not unheard of in today's day and age, that's someone's full-time job. But, you know, there is a lot of talk in writing, especially about pay equity. I think poetry pays, what, $10 a line, a minimum of $300 per poem. Can you talk about how pay relates to equity and inclusion?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we pay really well for literary journals, right? 96% of literary magazines don't have the resources to pay their contributors. 96%. And so we're fortunate, as a result of the gift that Ruth Lilly gave the foundation, that we're able to pay a little bit differently. And I think it ties into the idea not only of equity and inclusion, but how we support our art. You know, people need to eat, right? They got to pay their electric bill. I don't want to get too far away from this, but when my first book got published, I got $2,000 for the book, no royalties or anything, just $2,000. And I used that to pay my back rent, I used it to pay the electric bill for real. And then I used it to buy a pizza and a six pack for my girlfriend at the time and I. So that was it. My first book got my rent paid and my electric bill and a pizza. The what we want to do is make it so that poets don't have to make those choices and they can actually, at least in some level, have a different kind of lifestyle based on the resources that we can share. So I think the equity is about the resources. How, and one of the major questions that we've asked ourselves at the foundation and at the magazine is how can we share these more robustly? What can we do to support our community differently? And so one of the things that we did is we created a grants program through the foundation where literary organizations who support poets can apply for money from us, and we can help them support the their own agendas in the world, right? And so we just went through our very first one of those grant cycles, and there'll be another one coming up in the spring.
All right, we need to take a short break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Adrian Matika, the editor of Poetry Magazine. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening to my conversation with Adrian Matika, the editor of the Illinois-based Poetry Magazine. It was founded in Chicago in 1912, but more recently it's faced criticism in the past few years over how it responded to the killing of George Floyd in 2020 and whether it did enough to support poets during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. Because this conversation's on tape, we're not taking calls live, but as ever, you can let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. I want to ask you, because a long, long time ago, like millennia ago, poetry was arguably humankind's dominant form of conveying stories, right? Since then, prose, I think, has arguably become more ascendant in the form of the novel, and now, you know, we have movies and television and TikTok videos. What is the place of poetry in America, in the world in 2022?
Oh, Brian, that's so great. Listen, we just did a big project about there's a T.S. Eliot's poem slash book, The Wasteland. And it reminded me that Eliot, when he was alive, was the best-selling author in the world. And the only book that sold more copies than I think it was the Four Quartets from Eliot was the Bible, at least in English. And so to imagine that at one point poets could be bestsellers in that way is both kind of mind-boggling given our landscape, but also really wonderful to be reminded that there has been historically a great deal of love for poetry. I mean, poetry as an art is, for me, anyway, the most direct conduit to our heart, right? When you hear a poem, it goes from your ear to your brain to your heart. It's like music in that way. And so I've always imagined that it should be the most popular art form in the world, but it's not exactly, because like you said, we've got streaming services and we've got plays and we've got, you know, dance and all kinds of other opportunities to express ourselves. But what we've seen over the past maybe 5 to 10 years is a big increase in young people reading and writing poetry. Like the largest demographic, the largest increase in a demographic has been the 18 to 35-year-old reader and writer of poems. And in particular, writers from communities that have traditionally been marginalized. So there's a lot of enthusiasm for poetry among groups of people who feel like they have not had voices before. I think that's one of the great gifts of performance poetry, is that it allows people to tell their stories in a way that makes them feel vital. It's one of the reasons that social media has been so great. Like, I mean, before Twitter combusted, it was pretty awesome. You could post poems and people would share them. It was like the perfect venue to share poetry. You can't share a novel on Twitter, but you could share a poem, right? So now poets need to find a new place to go and to continue that sharing. But I think it's just the art form for our time, for people who are struggling to find the language to express how they feel inside of all of this very complicated and difficult change, right? I mean, we haven't even really begun to reckon with what happened to all of us in COVID, psychologically, emotionally, and all the rest. Poetry seems to me to be a good example of how one might work through that. It's not therapy. It's a space in which to examine emotion.
What will be the great works of literature to come out of COVID-19, like a modern Decameron?
Yeah, it's a real question. You know what I mean? Because we had the whole world shut down. So, you know, we live in a world full of artists and poets. And so eventually we're going to start to see this work filtering out. And I imagine sometimes, you know, when I've seen it at the magazine, sometimes it's very direct and you know specifically what's being alluded to, what's being considered and being, you know, what's being dissected. Other times it's a poem about cooking and then you realize that they're cooking and during lockdown. You know what I mean? There are a lot of different ways to examine experiences in poetry, and they don't always have to be direct. It's like Emily Dickinson said, sometimes they're told slant.
You know, you mentioned hip hop earlier in your own sort of formative experience. You know, there's a wide variety of hip hop, some less poetic, and then you get into like Common and, you know, people like that who are more in that realm. Talk about how that plays into that ascendancy especially among young people you were talking about.
Yeah, it's funny. I think all rappers are poets. I think that some of them are just not very good poets, you know. I teach a class at Indiana, or I did teach a class at Indiana that was called The Poetics of Rap. And we would look at rappers and look at their lyrics using the same devices that we use to talk about poetry. There are 14 different kinds of rhyme in rap music. And so, you know, and all of those rhymes exist, of course, in poetry as well. There are all kinds of different puns and allusions and wordplay that rappers use in really interesting and sometimes very sophisticated ways. And so it's a great way to introduce a younger generation of reader and listener to the possibilities of poetry. So we start out the class talking about rap music, but by the end, we're talking about poets like Chicago's own Nate Marshall, who is both a rapper and a poet, or Chance the Rapper, who started out as a poet. You know, there are people who, Eve Ewing is another poet who's phenomenal and is able to navigate a lot of different spaces. Jamila Woods, and I'm mentioning a lot of people from Chicago right now for those who are listening, but they're all people who've been influenced by rap music, even though they, you know, except for Nate, I don't think any of them want to actually be rappers. So I think there's a lot of intersection. There are intersections between these two great oral traditions, and it just happens to be that some rappers are better than others in terms of using poetic device.
Yeah, sure. Fair enough.
And I was really bad. I want to reiterate that. I was a terrible rapper. It's really important. I mean, I hope I'm not as terrible of a poet as I was a rapper. But, you know, Brian, can I mention something really quick?
Sure.
I wanted to go back because I was talking about our programs and partnership and innovation grants earlier. And I wanted to make sure if there was anybody who was listening, they knew how to get a hold of that. You can see the information on our website, but the deadline, the next deadline to apply is March 1st, and the grantee portal opens on January 6th. The grants are range between $10,000 and $75,000 to support nonprofit organizations that are invested in broadening the audiences of poetry and looking for new innovations in the field of poetry. So there are more details about that on the Poetry Foundation website, but I want to make sure people can find that if they are, in fact, part of one of those organizations that we might be able to support.
Yeah. Well, I do want to ask before our time ends about your own sort of one other aspect of your formation, which is you spent some time in downstate Illinois, the MFA program at Carbondale. Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that manifest in your work today?
Yeah. Oh, you know, I will never become the poet I hope to be if I had not gone to SIU Carbondale and studied with Rodney Jones and Allison Joseph, who is still there, and her husband, the late John Tribble, who was one of my great friends and mentors. And they, you know, everything that I am as an editor and as a writer, I learned from them. you know, John and Allison both ran a magazine called the Crab Orchard Review, and they founded it when I worked there when I was a grad student. So my first experience as an editor was watching the two of them being so careful and so thoughtful with the poet's work, and also fiction writers, because it was poetry and fiction, but with the writer's work as they curated these issues. And so I'm so grateful that I had that experience. And I miss John all the time. I'm always quoting things that he said to me, to my editorial team. And one of the things he said that I want to share with everybody, he said, poetry is not really that hard. All you have to do is have something to say and know how to write. I think about that all the time when we get submissions. And yeah, do they have something to say? Do they know how to break lines? Do they know what a sonnet is? If those two things line up, it's going to be a good poem.
Nice. Yeah, knowing how to write, that does help.
Right. It's just a small thing. Of
just that. No worries.
But no, it was great. And I also, I taught at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville for a while. So I have like some pretty thick ties with the southern part of the state. And, I can't imagine that Rodney Jones is listening right now. But when he was recruiting me to come to graduate school, he rightfully assumed that I wouldn't get out an atlas. Because, this was before the internet had everything on it, and there's no GPS yet. I wouldn't get on the atlas to see how far away from Carbondale, Chicago actually is. He's like, oh, yeah, you're really close to Chicago. No, we're not.
Yeah, closer to Mississippi, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's 45 minutes from Paducah, Kentucky.
Yeah.
And so it's nowhere near Chicago. And so the first time I tried to drive up here, it's like a 5.5-hour drive. And so I felt bamboozled. But my experience beyond that was really wonderful. So it's great to be back in the state too.
Well, you have a graphic novel on the way, Last on His Feet. We don't have too much time to get into that. Maybe we can have you back for that. I would love to end though, if you could read us some of your poetry as a way to end.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Maybe just a couple of short poems. Would that work?
Yeah.
Okay. And I do have a graphic novel coming out. I'm so excited about it. It took me 6 years to write. And the illustrator's name is Youssef Daoudi, and he's a Moroccan illustrator. So I'm sure he's very excited right now about France and Morocco playing in the World Cup. I'm just going to read two poems. The book is called, my most recent book is called Somebody Else Sold the World. And I got the title of the book. The title is in response to a David Bowie song, The Man Who Sold the World.
Of the Nirvana version first, but yes.
Yeah, right. Well, that version brought the song back for a lot of people, right? Because it was amazing on MTV Unplugged. And, then after that, David Bowie started playing it again, which was really great. But I've been a huge fan of Bowie, my whole life. And so The Man Who Sold the World, his song is based on a poem by a sort of not particularly well-known poet named Hugh Murns, and it's called Antagonish. And basically the poem is about somebody walking down the stairs and seeing an apparition. But David Bowie's song is about the apparition, like seeing an apparition, but the apparition is the commercialized version of himself. And he doesn't like what he sees when he sees that he's, like sort of recognizing himself as being someone who might have compromised their own, ethical or moral values. So the whole book is about like being compromised during COVID by the government. So this one's called Somebody Else Sold the World. And it takes place at the beginning of COVID. Somebody else sold the world. And before I knew it, the violet sky flagged with the sun's violent demands. For magnolias in bloom, natural light, any place magnanimous without locks or doors, different kinds of masks for being and breathing. The antagonists with their vanity tans and usual mischiefs whistled jingles about liberties and war as we buttoned up in our confinement and we dreamed about hugging. We talked about was and when we missed our friends and dentist appointments. Molars dropped out without breathable air. Hair forgot its natural colors without testimonies at intersections and barbecues. Words lost their family recipes, friends lost their words, then lost their parents. A mass few found love somehow in the gerrymandered grocery lines and farmers' fields upturned with unsellable vegetables. So the antagonists cornered the curfews, manufacturing arguments with guns at the ready like henchmen. The air around them was so ripe, we might have broken in half if we could touch it. And I'll read a really short one after that.
We don't have applause with just the two. No, I was just saying we don't have an applause soundtrack, but it's happening all over Illinois for the listeners.
Did you just hook me? You bring out that shepherd's hook?
No. I'm saying it's just, poetry on the radio sometimes. It is.
Yeah, no doubt.
It's powerful. I want to hear another.
Yeah, if it's okay, I'll just read one more and we can wrap it up. Because I'm thinking about rap music and I have a poem inspired by Travis Scott called Highest, and it was inspired by his song, I'm the Highest in the Room. And I thought that would be a good way to end this. Highest. I rise up, therefore I must be like Descartes if he didn't finish all the reading. I raise up like the highest black hand in history class. I am risen like the blood pressure of anybody black mimeographed in this chronic textbook of a monochromatic year. That's infant mortality rate high. That's high top fade high. Most everything up here hangs threadbare, squarely in the red line of summary excuses. Everything else up here, from the cop apologies to the solidarity statements, a double tap of distraction for somebody else's high sign. That's unemployment high. That's Machu Picchu high. What a relief. Hardly anybody stuck around to see me on the low side of the mountain. What a reprieve, because I kept rising stealthily, past my historical anxiety, way past my inherited hearsay, say until I am so high up on the shelf, eye level alchemy. Even up here, I'm adept at shrinking myself for safety. Even up here, my shoulders hunch like a small analogy.
Adrian Matika, we have about 2 minutes before we have to break. So let me ask you, do you still have time to write? Is now that you're editing full time this magazine?
You know, that's been one of the big struggles. This is a really wonderful and also very demanding position. And when I came into it, I just kind of made a pact with myself that I would keep working, keep writing. But my real goal for the next, however long I'm here, is to try to figure out how to make room for other poets and how to really focus on not only enabling, but trumpeting the voices, the incredible diversity of voices in poetry right now. And I learned really quickly that the same reservoir I use to write is the same reservoir I use to edit with care. It's the same reservoir I use to teach, and to be a good friend, all of that, like that emotional reservoir that we have, I use it for all of these different things. And so right now it just needs to be used to support other poets.
Adrian Matika is the editor of Poetry Magazine. His most recent book is Somebody Else Sold the World. And pretty soon, next year, you'll be able to read his first graphic novel, which is called Last on His Feet. Adrian Matika, this has been great. Thanks so much for speaking with us today on the 21st Show. Good luck with the magazine.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks so much for making space for me today. I really appreciate it.
And that was my conversation with Adrian Matika, the editor of Poetry Magazine. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.